Welcome to Warships Pod, and my guest on this episode is Tom Sharp, who spent 27 years in the Royal Navy, 20 of which were at sea. He commanded four different warships, including a fishery protection vessel, a Type 23 frigate, HMS St. Albans, and the ice patrol vessel HMS Endurance. Today, he is a partner at SPP, an international communications consultancy, and also writes for the Daily Telegraph, and occasionally for Warships IFR. Welcome, Tom.
Thanks, Ian.
It's a busy time for navies, as we're both well aware. But I think before we come to that, and I know you've got some very interesting things to say about what's happening around the world, and in particular in the Middle East and also the Mediterranean, but could I just get some sense of your background and how you came to be in the Royal Navy and some of the milestones in your career, a bit more on some of those commands that I mentioned a second ago?
Yeah, of course. I joined young. I joined straight from school. I was wrestling with a university place when the Navy said, no, join us and we'll give you a degree. So that's what I did. And then that was about the first 4 years from 18 to my early 20s. And then I went straight to sea, as warfare officers tend to do. And I spent my time in a variety of ships in the first 5 or 6 years, including a mine hunter. And then I went into a fishery protection vessel. And that's where I got my early sort of promotion to command. I ended up in command of HMS Lindisfarne, age 28, which was fantastic and a real privilege. And I was kind of fairly inexperienced at that point, so having to lean heavily on what was a very experienced ship's company, which taught me a great deal. Then I went from there to a Northern Ireland command, a couple of years running out of Faz Lane and doing the job in and out of Belfast and then up and down the coast of Ireland. So quite punchy, quite demanding, quite samey, if I'm honest, compared to, say, fishery protection. But again, good early command exposure. Then I broke for the warfare course 1 year, the PWO course, as it's known, a year alongside, normally ostensibly to learn about how to fight a frigate or destroyer. From there, then into the sort of the bigger ships. I went to a frigate as the PWO, then the destroyer as an air warfare officer, and then into the aircraft carrier Ark Royal as the senior warfare officer. So good surface ship exposure in different types of ships. From there, I was now sort of starting to get back into the command cycle again. So I was sent to HMS Endurance. She was deployed for 18 months. As the second in command, due to an accident we had down south where we flooded and actually then had to scrap the ship, I ended up in command for a short period in her before going to HMS St. Albans, a towed array frigate, spending a year in the Gulf doing maritime security operations there, and then a year doing towed array operations up north. That was the end of my seagoing career. From there, I went to do my master's and then on to the planning desk in our joint headquarters. And I had a specific focus there on the Middle East and specifically Iran. So again, a very useful background. But I left there to go to the press office in the Ministry of Defence. That was my last job in the Navy. So that was the communications hook at the end of all of this sea time and operational experience that then enabled me to be headhunted by a communications agency. And it was at that point, after nearly 27 years, that I left the Navy. So quite a varied seagoing career, very operational focused until the end. Last 5 years, really plans and communications.
Just so that some readers are aware of what we're talking about there, PWO is Principal Warfare Officer. So you specialised in above water, not underwater. Is that right? Were you an anti-air officer, as it were?
Yeah. So PWO is exactly that. You're one of two minimum sort of officers in the ship who have responsibility for the operational capability of that warship, so the fighting effectiveness of the ship. And you do specialize early into air and underwater. And yes, I was the POA, Principal Warfare Officer, brackets air, in HMS Somerset. And I had an opposite number who was the POU doing the submarine stuff. But the reality is, when you're in your defense watches, which is how you spend most of your time in somewhere like the Gulf, you're 6 hours about with your oppo, and you're covering both. So you're sort of, my specialization at that point was gunnery. And we used that a lot in that tour in 2004. We were there just after Telek 2. We were firing shot across the bow almost every day. So we were very, very busy, and it was quite tense. We were essentially trying to keep vessels away from the Iraqi oil platforms that had been fishing there and spending their entire lives there, and they were no longer allowed anywhere near them because there was a threat to those oil platforms. So we were there to separate out So it was very busy, very tense, and it was a difficult environment up there as well.
Right, so that was in HMS Somerset, was it?
Correct.
Yeah, okay, Type 23 or Duke-class Type 23 frigates. So, okay, so you, like many sailors, and in fact some journalists like myself, spent a fair bit of time, although obviously I only visited, in the Gulf and up threat in the Northern Gulf, where the post the invasion of Iraq 2003, there was then the Iraqi infrastructure, because I think that's where you're talking about, the area you're talking about. And so the Royal Navy's job, along with the US Coast Guard and others, was to basically secure them from attack by Al-Qaeda. And would that be why you were trying to keep the fishing vessels away?
Exactly right. There was a suicide threat to us as well. In fact, whilst we were on route on the way out there, they detonated alongside a US boat and killed, I think, 8 of their sailors. So there was a suicide threat to us and a suicide threat to the oil platforms. So actually under self-defense, under the rules of engagement that allow you to engage an incoming threat, the oil platforms were deemed self-defense. So quite robust. It meant we had strong rules to enforce these exclusion zones around the oil rigs. And like so much of at sea, it's distinguishing between the fisherman that's going back home because he's been on that route for the last 30 years, and the one that's going packed full of explosives and heading to destroy the Iraqi economy by taking out their oil platform is very, very difficult to distinguish. And the operating conditions up there put layers of difficulty on top of that, or what is already a complex problem. So yeah, you're very alert. You had to be on your game for weeks at a time. It was tough.
Yeah, I visited HMS Chatham Type 22 frigate in 2008 when she was doing that job. And that was in the wake of the 2007 HMS Cornwall incident. In simple terms, that was when the Iranians in those tricky contested waters managed to capture, I think it was it one rib full of Royal Navy sailors and some Marines, or maybe a couple of ribs that were carrying out a boarding to inspect a vessel, and then quite famously put them on television. And then they were, the UK and Iran negotiated, and they came home.
You know, not to sort of air the 22's dirty laundry particularly, but they got caught out a wee bit. And although having said that, the Iranians timed their attack perfectly. They were half on and half off the vessel that had just boarded. When you're completely vulnerable, you've lost your maneuverability. Everyone, the rib is up alongside the merchant vessel that's moving along at a decent speed. So they really kind of executed it very well. But then there was no overwatch, so the helicopter wasn't up, and the ship was nowhere to be seen. Now, I'm afraid to say, you know, those are a couple of basic items that should have been in place. Clearly, it was a lot more complicated than that. And the aftermath was, you know, well publicized at the time, and really changed. It changed the way the Navy operated up there, but dare I say it, probably changed it back to how we'd been doing it in 2004, where we were very aggressive, we were very on point. Like I say, we fired almost every weapon up to including the 30 millimeter cannons in very, very constrained waters to get. And we think we probably diverted a couple of potential attacks as well in so doing. So it was successful up there, but it was tough.
Yeah. So when you say fired them, what you mean is putting shots across the bows or near vessels that potentially were going to make a suicide run, packed with explosives against one of the platforms up there. Is that what you mean when you say fired?
Yeah, exactly right. So you have a sequence of escalatory measures that start from, you know, on the radio trying to call them up. And that generally doesn't have any effect. I mean, but again, back to my point about, is this a fishing boat going home or a skiff, you know, fat packed with explosives? Either way, they're probably not going to answer you on the radio. So you have to go through all these measures. I mean, essentially what you have to do is determine intent. So once the radio has inevitably failed, you then have to start coming up with things that they can't not see. So sirens, even the saluting gun, which makes an enormous noise. By now you're starting to uncover weapons, you're closing people up. You know, these are all now visible sequencing. Again, trying to establish intent. Speed is another good one, particularly if they're coming towards you. If you increase speed and maneuver and they maneuver with you, bingo, you've got intent. You know they're now coming for you, not just going home and not paying attention. So it's all about establishing intent and then trying to deter them. And ultimately, once you've fired your saluting gun, once you've shouted at them on the radio, once you've done all these sort of non-kinetic measures, that the penultimate layer in the escalation is a shot across the bow. And depending on where they were and whether it was day or night, would depend on what weapon system you selected to do that. So generally speaking, from the call going up to putting a round in the water, we could do that at any time of day or night in about a minute. So very quick. The engineers at very high state of readiness to get the sprint engines on, because speed is your friend in these instances, either to get in the way or to get out of the way, depending on the situation. But it's very shallow. The sea surface temperature is very high, so your equipment is running on the sort of ragged edge all the time. You're sucking in all sorts of things into your inlets, particularly if you go at a high speed. So it's not a nice environment, and the radars don't really work very well. There's lights, literally thousands of lights everywhere, because all these boats are just sort of hanging lanterns, and you can't. And the radar just looks like a sort of attack of the measles. So the bridge team are constantly on high alert, trying to visually identify what these things are, talk to the ops room. So it's a real team effort. And you would come off your 6 hours in the ops room pretty drained every time, every day for months.
Right. So you were, was it PWO? What area was it when you were out there in the Northern Gulf in Somerset?
I was the PWO-A.
So that's the anti-air warfare.
Right. Yeah. And so I was responsible for every time we fired the weapon. Now, that was a command decision. I mean, I don't necessarily want to go into this, but we had an interesting command environment at the time. I had to be the guy giving the command and control for the weapons, irrespective of whether I was in my 6 hours off or not. And I was the operations officer in charge of the planning cycle of the ship. So yeah, it was a proper sleep-deprived environment. But very tense, very, very high pace, but rewarding when we got it right. And we were finding our way with the US task groups up there. It was a good trip.
Right. So being in that position in HMS Somerset, Type 23 frigate, you then later became the captain of HMS St. Albans, another Type 23. By that time, events had moved on and it was a different kind of thing down towards the southern end. And this time you were concerned, now in the hot seat as the CO, with the Strait of Hormuz. Is that correct? Yeah.
That's right. We still at this point had two frigates assigned to the area. It was called Operation Kipien, and you'd have Kipien 1 and Kipien 2. Kipien 1 was us, and that meant in the Gulf. Essentially, in and around the Straits of Hormuz, in the central and southern Gulf, not so much in the north. In fact, we generally kept away from there. That threat had died down and there was nothing really to do. So most of what we were doing was in low-level intelligence gathering, boarding operations and presence operations. You know, we were to an extent there to fly the White Ensign on behalf of UK Gov and show that presence that ships and navies are so good at doing. The boarding was tough. It was very, very hot. We were up to sort of 50 degrees, generally speaking, by day. So we had to manage that quite carefully. But the other thing that was very good about that trip was our sonar. And by now we were pretty much the fleet experts in operating a Merlin helicopter with our towed array sonar. And you get those two working together well. And it's a very, very powerful capability. It still is 10, 12 years on, but back then it was really good. So both US carrier battle groups that were there during my time, the George W. Bush at the start, and then the John C. Stennis took over from her. We became their anti-submarine warfare commander, which is a fantastic position to be in. Working with the US Navy is brilliant fun, but you do have to bring something to the party. Or you get relegated. You can become B team quite quickly with a US task group, and there's a sort of set of rules about how you operate with them, and I understood them from previously, and we had this bit of kit that they didn't have. You know, their destroyers have very capable sonars for detecting submarines. Annoyingly capable, given that they were an afterthought. In fact, the Arleigh Burke we'll come back to, but I spent most of my career envying those amazing ships. But we had this variable depth sonar and a Merlin, and it was very interesting. I remember being on the Stennis, and the admiral who was in charge of the entire task group. I was peddling our UK lines to take, which was that the Type 45 destroyer was about to come out for the first time. And we were very excited about this, in quotes. And I was telling the Admiral we were very excited about this, about this new capability we'd just built. And he said, Tom, you know, look around you. Look around you at my task group. Do you think I need another destroyer? Because right. What I need yeah. is for you not to leave.
If I could just interrupt just there for a second, because, again, I just want to make sure that everybody knows what we're talking about, because, I mean, I know what you're saying, but the towed array is a sonar that, in simple terms, you have on the end of a long cable or wire, and you put it at a distance from the noise, the self-generated noise from the warship, the Type 23 frigate, so that it can hear better what other vessels might be up to. And, I mean, it's been used in submarines as well to detect, in the Cold War, Soviet submarines. So when you say variable depth, do you mean the towed array, or was the variable depth on top of the sonar, variable depth sonar on top of the towed array?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and it is quite techy. So let me just, I'll unpack it very briefly. There are two parts to 2087, which is the towed array I'm referring to. Only one part of which is the towed array. The other part is a towed body. Okay, so the towed body comes out of the back, and that's your active array. That's the thing that pings, like any old good old fashioned war movie. You can hear the pinging noise, and that's variable depth, and it goes straight down. It deploys straight down, and the huge advantage of that is that in any body of water, sound doesn't travel in a straight line. It curves based on temperature, salinity, sea state, and all sorts of other variable factors. And you can quickly find yourself in a situation where the curve is such that you get trapped in a layer. The sound gets trapped in a layer. And at that point, it doesn't matter how much power you put into that sonar, you're not penetrating that layer. Now, of course, submarines operate knowing this all the time, and they will operate beneath that layer, very simplistic terms. And then you cannot hear them with a bow-mounted sonar, no matter how much power you put through it. The advantage of our towed body was that you could vary the depth a lot and put this active body beneath that layer, and you would set it depending on the conditions of the day, which, as I say, vary a lot. And then the second part was the actual array, the bit of string, if you like, that goes out of the back. And that really, in our case, was for receiving the signal back from the towed body. So the body pings, it hits the submarine or whatever it is you're looking for. And then the array out the back receives that signal, processes it, and it ends up in the ops room. And you make your evaluation on that. So complex bit of kit made simple, hopefully.
One thing to ask you there, it's actually a very interesting question, because I know you're going to give a very interesting answer. But just to set my question up, you were aboard, you were in command of HMS St. Albans when, 2010?
2011? Yeah, 2010 to 2012, yeah.
Okay, so when I was aboard HMS Chatham in the Northern Gulf doing a different job in 2008, one of the things I was fairly shocked by, because I've visited various ships around the world and also in the Gulf, was they had no, what I would call, proper sonar setup. In fact, they had a machine in a corner, just to use simple terms, that was basically ready to be fired up, and they had a few guys on hand to go in there and use that. And it seemed that they weren't worried at all about the Iranian submarine threat, because in our minds, anybody that studied it, it was down to three rusty old Russian-provided Kilo-class diesel-electric submarines. So by the time you were in command of St. Albans in 2010, 2011, out there in the Gulf, in a different area, and so valuable with the towed array and the variable depth sonar as well, as part of it, had the Iranian submarine threat changed by then? Had they acquired a new capability under the sea?
Yeah, a really good question. And back to your time there, I think that was probably we did let anti-submarine warfare lapse a little bit, as sort of in the early noughties when the Russians stopped coming over the top. We let the capability lapse, and the investment in the people and the equipment did definitely die away. I was lucky. We were on the up roll of recovering that and pushing a lot of resources and time and effort into making sure that the situation you've described, where we, you know, where it was paid lip service to, was very much not the case. It was our key fighting function. And as I say, having that to offer to the Americans made us focus very carefully. The Iranian threat, the kilos were still there. Now we operated extensively with a UK nuclear submarine who came out. I won't say the name because I'll embarrass him, but we did some extraordinarily good work with them simulating the Iranian threat, and they would operate as if they were one of those Kilo submarines. So they were depth limited. They had to come up every now and again for air, and so on and so on. So really, the real focus in anti-submarine terms at that point was the Yono submarines, the mini submarines, of which I think at the time they had 11, and one or two would be at sea at any moment. And they sit in the strait there, hovering in the traffic separation scheme. They're pretty horrible bits of kit. There's, I think, about six or eight sailors on them, and they carry a couple of heavyweight torpedoes. And they've got two jobs. Well, the first one is to sit there and count ships out. The second one is to release one of these heavyweight torpedoes if the fighting starts. So if that happens, if this got nasty, you would want to locate and destroy those Yono submarines as quickly as possible. So that was part of our remit. Now, they operate in such shallow water, we couldn't use the variable depth sonar that I've just described there anyway. And actually, politically, we weren't allowed to operate that sonar in the Gulf. In fact, we weren't allowed to operate it in the Strait. I asked a lot. I really wanted to try this thing because it's so important to understand the body of water you're going to fight in. And so I wanted to trail this thing and take it through the Strait and take it into the Gulf. But that was deemed politically too aggressive, too forward-leaning. We were breaking our normal operating pattern. So that permission was denied, which, it's a classic sort of thing as a captain you get angry about and say, well, we should be doing this. And you get a very quiet, don't ask that again. Nevertheless, the Yono was very much in our front of mind. And believe it or not, how do you destroy a very small submarine in very shallow, very noisy water? It's a challenge. And we had a couple of innovative solutions, one of which involved our main gun. And we started working out how deep that could go and still have an effect, how deep the shells could go and still have an effect. And we took some pretty old fashioned depth charges with us as well, because you can see these things if you know where they are, and go a little bit kind of World War II on them. That was very much part of our remit. And again, back with the Americans, if this had turned to a fight, they would have looked to us to neutralize anything out at sea, perhaps the Kilos, and or the Yonos.
Right. I mean, I find that extraordinary. I was just thinking when you were talking about the gun and the depth charges, about submarine history going way back to World War One, when people were actively seeking to do that and did do it, and obviously developed the depth charge during World War One as well. So it just seems crazy, doesn't it, to hobble a sophisticated warship like the Type 23 with that sonar for political reasons. But I guess that's what happens.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. And also, it just goes to show that, that the pursuance of technological solutions to so much of this, it just goes to show, and I suppose Ukraine and the Russia thing also has shown time after time that good old-fashioned technology still has its place on the battlefield.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. And that is always something that people are trying to strive for, isn't it? Something that's a bit unconventional, but maybe harking back a little bit to outwit the modern digital warrior. And but staying with the Gulf and going around the corner into the Red Sea, maybe bring things forward to today. The most extraordinary thing that has happened just a few days ago was, of course, the USS Carney shooting down, well, the figures differ, but 3 to 4 Houthi-fired, and we'll have to explain what the Houthis are, Houthi-fired land attack cruise missiles, and also up to 15 drones as well from a position off the coast of Yemen. During your time in St. Albans, and maybe you can then reflect on what happened last week as well, was there a perceived danger from anybody in Yemen, or was that as a result of the civil war there that came later, where the Houthis have rebelled against the government? So has it always been a dangerous part to transit from through the narrow straits of Bab el Mandeb up to the Suez Canal? Has it always been a danger zone?
It has. In fact, quite often the threat assessment in the Bab el Mandeb, the BAM, obviously we have to abbreviate everything, was sometimes higher than in the Strait of Hormuz. It's very narrow, kind of, I think, 8 miles, 8 nautical miles at its narrowest point. The radar is very cluttered. And there's a lot of smuggling there as well. There's a lot of unlit boats zipping backwards and forwards. Back to my earlier point about threat identification. How do you know? So we found if we went, the best time to go through the Bab el Mandeb was at first light. So we would get our Merlin up. Again, the larger helicopter had the legs to stay up for 2 or 3 hours, even in that heat. Whereas if you've got a Lynx, you've got to get it back, perhaps even half an hour later to refuel. So we put the Merlin up. It would look forward with its various cameras and kit and sweep the entrance. And we would then scoot through as the light came up. So you could now see the skiffs darting backwards and forwards because they quite often don't paint on radar. So yeah, it's always been an edgy place to operate. And certainly ships and I never did it. I always scooted through the Red Sea. My tasking in both frigates wasn't there. So I never had to hang around. Although one of the other problems with the Bab el Mandeb is that everyone knows you're coming. You've just been through Suez. You've shouted your position loud and clear on the radio, and there are only so many speeds you can go down the Red Sea. So anyone doing speed times distance can sit and wait for you in that very narrow choke point and set up whatever it is they're going to set up. It was always slightly uncomfortable. Once you're out and you're in the Gulf of Aden and beyond, you know, happy days. You've now got freedom to maneuver, and you can, and then really your course and speed to Hormuz is very variable at that point. So no one really knows when you're going to arrive there. But the Bab el Mandeb. So for the Carney to go through Suez. Now, admittedly, she'd come from the Eastern Med, which isn't a threat-free zone, or wasn't even then, whenever we're talking about now, 10 days ago. Yeah. So she would have been high alert. But even so, the Red Sea is a very different operating environment to the Eastern Med, acoustically, atmospherically, in terms of temperature. So back to my point about understanding the theatre you're in, she had almost no time to adjust before this attack happened. So that she then shot down. Yeah, I mean, again, the numbers vary. I think maybe 4 cruise missiles and 19 drones, depending on which report you believe. But let's just call it a lot. Yeah. To engage all of them, 100%, on the first day in a new theater. Hats off to them. That's a good day in the ops room. And they did it with a combination of their own missiles and their gun, their 5-inch gun. And we can come back to that if you want. But either way, good for them.
Yeah. So the Carney, Arleigh Burke-class destroyer, you expressed your admiration for them earlier. I mean, once described by a US Navy officer writing for the magazine as the new dreadnought, the 21st century dreadnought. But that was 20 years ago. So they're quite old. But in terms of testing their full gamut of weaponry, new to the game, maybe, in this extent. Although a previous Arleigh Burke-class destroyer, the USS Mason, was reportedly fired at by the Houthis using anti-shipping missiles in 2016, and the Americans dealt with those. One was splashed on the way, and I think they took out another one, and they then blitzed the launch site. So the Americans had a taste of it before, courtesy of the Iranian-backed Houthi rebels. And one of the things we've covered in the magazine is interceptions by American and British warships of arms shipments from Iran to Yemen for these Houthis, including the elements of land attack cruise missiles and other serious bits of kit. So when they fired the land attack missiles the other day, do you think it was soon assessed that the and you're only giving us your, you know, off the top of your head analysis here, but do you think it was soon assessed in the ops room that those were, the flight profile was such that it was a cruise missile heading north down the sea, and that the drones, I mean, what a distraction, or maybe they were long-range drones, I don't know. So using your insight into ops rooms, do you think they very quickly understood the kind of threat they were looking at and whether or not it was aimed at them?
I think they would have. It does depend on where they were in the Red Sea. If they were because it does get quite wide quite quickly. Whilst I said it's very narrow at the BAM, it widens out quite quickly. So if they were right up against Saudi territorial waters, then these cruise missiles could very quickly have looked like an incoming threat to them. If they were in the middle of the Red Sea, just following sort of point to point from Suez, then there would have been some displacement, roughly 30 miles. So, and they're very different. They are very different propositions if in the opsim of a ship, because your rules of engagement suddenly change. One is self-defense. You think they fire, let's just deal with the cruise missiles for now, and we'll come onto the drones in a second. One is self-defense. Three missiles are coming at you. You know that they're going fast, probably subsonic in this case. They're not squawking. They're not conforming to air lanes. They're not responding to any. So, and they're not on a flight plan. You've got all of this information. They're not conforming to anything. They're moving very fast. There's three of them in formation. I'm assuming, I don't know if there was a separation in time between them, but you're going to fairly quickly realize that this is a missile attack. Now you're into the conundrum. Is it coming for us or is it going somewhere else? And therefore, what are my rules of engagement? If it's coming for you, self-defense, every captain has the inherent right of self-defense. No one can take that away from you. Easy, engage at maximum range. If they're not coming for you, then you've got a bit of a problem. Is where are they going? Who's fired them? And are they still a legitimate target? So again, back to the sort of the command and control part of this, and how switched on that ship was to really quickly assess and then engage. It does depend on how far down the Red Sea they were as well, and therefore how much time did they have to make these assessments. But either way, you're talking minutes. So yeah, it's pretty sharp.
I read somewhere that it was a 9-hour engagement, so the ops room would have had to stay very sharp for a long time, really. What the level of stress was in there, I don't know. But the interesting thing you mentioned earlier, and you said we'd probably come back to it, so I'll pull you back to it, is the 5-inch gun. And that's another one of those surprising solutions. Maybe not surprising to a naval officer like yourself or anybody that knows they have main guns, because modern warships, for those of our listeners that are not aware of it, which probably aren't many, have probably one or two main guns, which are medium caliber, which will be, in the case of the Royal Navy, 4.5-inch gun. And in the future, the Royal Navy will have 5-inch guns as well. But the US Navy has 5-inch guns on its cruisers, one each end, and on the Arleigh Burke, one. So that is using a gun, in a big gun, which is a fairly big gun in anti-aircraft or anti-missile tasking, is something which might surprise people today when we've got all the high tech, you know, of missiles. So do you think that they had airburst rounds, or would they have been able to actually shoot down precisely with a gun like that?
Yeah, the 5-inch, the great advantage of the 5-inch, I mean, obviously the extra caliber over our gun gives it extra range. The bigger the bullet, the further it goes. It's fairly straightforward. The big advantage of the 5-inch gun is how many navies have got it, and therefore the breadth of ammunition you can put in this thing. And it turns out that one of their rounds they have is essentially a shotgun. It's like a shotgun cartridge. And it actually detonates at range. So you're not just firing down a bearing. When I first heard that they'd engaged with the gun, with their main gun, I thought that was incredibly punchy, because if it doesn't hit the target and the HE warhead doesn't detonate, where's that shell going? If you're not careful, that's going in someone else's country, and that's a bad thing. But it turns out this thing will actually frag at a preset distance, which is fantastic. Now, drones are a problem in some respects, because so many weapon systems are configured for fast-moving missiles. And the slower you go, you can sometimes defeat those systems. We certainly had this with the low, slow threat. Some of your radars won't even pick it up because they're just configured for sea-skimming missiles and what have you. So something doing 100 knots or 50 knots or less is going to, you know, can potentially cause you a problem. So again, back to the US system of detection and assessment, their spy radar, which was brilliant when it came out in the early 90s and has continued to just develop and get better and better, combined with their command system. And then at the end of this, the weapon system really, again, came together in very short order. Now, if the drones were set to distract the ship, rather like the Ukrainians did with the Moskva, then that's that shouldn't work. I think I can't speak authoritatively on how the US train for these scenarios. I do know that they envy our training to some extent down in Plymouth with Flag Officer C training staff, but that's very comprehensive. But you're put through the ringer to such an extent there where you come under every conceivable attack at the same time, from submarine to surface fast attack craft to missiles to, you know, the whole, and you just train until it becomes so instinctive that if you allowed slow moving drones to distract you from fast moving missiles, then that would be embarrassing. That would be an epic fail. So that's not to you know, diminish the Americans' achievement here, what they did. But if I wouldn't expect drones to distract them too long from three or four cruise missiles.
Yeah, and the supposed target, there's nothing for sure. Nobody's said it for sure because they obviously didn't get there. It was supposed to be southern Israel, their port holiday resort on the Red Sea. So beyond what's happening at the moment in the Israel versus Hamas war, the attack, the terrorist attack by Hamas on Israel itself, and then the investment, the siege of Gaza by the Israeli forces, which, like the Hamas attack, is killing civilians as the machine of war grinds into place, because that's what happens in all wars, and it's a terrible tragedy. There's also the geopolitical side of it, and if we can now sail out of the Red Sea through the Suez Canal into the Eastern Med in this podcast, there's manoeuvring going on, certainly from the US Navy point of view, and the Royal Navy is also there, and the Royal Fleet Auxiliary, the UK support force. There's a lot of ships being moved around by the Americans and European nations, but also maybe the Russians and the Chinese. So do you have any thoughts on the use of naval power to make geopolitical signalling and maybe deterrence? What's your sort of take on what's been going on there?
It's been really interesting to track over the last couple of weeks. US have been very forthright in what they're doing and who they're moving and when. They've been very forward-leaning in their communications, which is a point all of its own. They're using communications, they're using information ops as a weapon. They're saying, we're moving this group, we're doing this, we're doing that. So whilst it's been busy in terms of US Navy ship movements, if you paid attention, you can track who's doing what at any one time. It was interesting very early when there was a sense of, this is just gently reshuffling the deck. The Ford was already there in the west, in the central Mediterranean. She sprinted east, but she was already there. So no real change. And then the Eisenhower group, the Nimitz class carrier, so slightly smaller than the Ford, but still immense. Her deployment was accelerated, but her deployment was going to take her into the Med anyway. So for a few days there was this sort of sense that we're just upping the ante a wee bit. Nothing to see here. There were plenty of people going, yeah, this is just business as usual. And then it started to, and then it kept going. And at some point you go, no, okay, these are now unplanned movements in response to the developing situation. The two that struck me were the extension of the USS Ford in theater. That's a Secretary of Defense level sign off to keep one of those ships on station longer. So you've now got their head of the show basically saying, yeah, she needs to stay. That's not planned. That's reactive. Then you got the ships of the 26th Marine Expeditionary Unit in the Gulf, the USS Bataan and the Hall. And there's another one, actually, the Mesa Verde, but she was already in the rota. But those two ships of the 26th MU were then dispatched from the Gulf. Okay, that's definitely a shift, and that is not planned, but has some very interesting second order effects, which we can come back to. And then the final one was the USS Mount Whitney, one of their command ships, as a three-star admiral on board, a vice admiral, was relieved of its NATO duties. Again, already in the Med, but the NATO staff were taken off and it started heading east. So it transitioned from nothing to see here, just reshuffling the pack a wee bit, to, okay, we've now got an armada either in or heading for the Eastern Mediterranean. And as I said at the start, very vocal in the transmission of this.
So the purpose of all this, and we also maybe should give a mention to the Royal Fleet Auxiliary Lyme Bay, which is a landing ship, a British landing ship, and the RFA Argus, which is now these days a sort of how should we say, makeshift landing platform helicopter carrier being used by Britain to send commandos and some helicopters to the Mediterranean and presumably heading for the Eastern Med. And the French have got at least one frigate there, two frigates there. Now, they're now sending their helicopter carrier, their proper helicopter carrier, to the Eastern Mediterranean as well. So the whole purpose of this, some people misunderstand because they don't know about what you've just been talking about, signalling and deterrence. So the whole purpose of naval forces with power, military power, residing in them, moving them around the world to certain parts of the world, is to send a signal to other people, I would say, in the case of the Israel versus Hamas war that's erupted, the current one, but rather to others. So who do you think, the answer may be obvious to us, but who do you think are the main targets of the signalling of and the placement of all that naval power?
You're absolutely right. And people default very quickly in these conversations to fighting power, numbers of missiles, numbers of jets, and it ignores the, let's just take a single US carrier strike group, the breadth of capability that those things have. And it's basically everything. And it starts at deterrence. It starts at intelligence gathering. They've got their own, it's like a sort of mobile intelligence gathering suite. And it's not just the ships either. It's a whole array of organic aircraft and other assets. I mean, they're being fed an intelligence picture. So it's a fusion cell. It's a mobile fusion cell that just happens to have a bunch of jets and missiles as well. But that's how it starts. So you're really your information ops, your deterrence is absolutely fundamental to this, all the way to warfighting. I mean, two US carrier strike groups, which at a brief moment in time they will be in the Eastern Med, can start and finish a war on their own. So, what are they actually for? What are they doing? Was a question asked a lot, and the answer is they can do everything. But if you look at the units that are there, particularly the 26th MEU units, the Bataan, then the French carriers, and then our Royal Fleet auxiliaries, it's very clear that there's the potential for a mass evacuation here, the requirement for a mass non-combatant evacuation operation, a NEO, another abbreviation, obviously. So the potential for a NEO, and that's what all these heavy ships, let's call them that, the bigger ships, are geared up to do. Now, at that point, the carrier strike groups are really more in the business of protecting and throwing an umbrella, protective umbrella, over those heavy ships, because the closer into land you go, the more vulnerable you become.
Yeah, and it throws me back to, I'm sure that it's also in your mind, to the 2006 evacuation of UK citizens from the Lebanon, when Israel and Hezbollah, the military group, another terrorist army that controls much of what happens in the Lebanon, and even now is exchanging fire with the Israelis on the northern border. So back then in 2006, though, I sensed there was a bit of complicit cooperation between the Lebanese government, Hezbollah, and the UK in getting people out, UK nationals out, during the 2006 war, because ships went alongside. And I remember helicopters flew in from Cyprus as well, and there were quite a few Royal Navy vessels there doing that. But I don't think in this instance that there would be the same sort of tacit agreement to let the evacuation go ahead. So with two American strike groups there, of course, it's a whole bigger level anyway. Do you think it'd be a whole level above in terms of risk and danger to navies to get people out?
I think so. I don't, as you say, it's very unlikely that there'll be any form of, high level permissiveness in terms of going alongside. And a ship alongside, as the USS Cole proved in Aden, is ultimately vulnerable. You've lost all the things that are in your favor in terms of lead, defense, maneuverability, predictability, and even time, even if it's any seconds. You've lost all of that. You're now stuck alongside. So in order to go in, you've got to provide some assurance of those ships' safety, or take a very high degree of risk, because if you're disembarking thousands of civilians and that ship then gets hit, then clearly there's going to be a tragic loss of life. So the deterrence piece in terms of who is this messaging for, who's it for? Well, it's everybody. I mean, China, Russia, Iran, Hamas, Hezbollah. Now, Hamas and Hezbollah are going to be deterred by large carrier groups 200 miles out to sea? No, they're not. Will the Iranians, Russians, or Chinese? I mean, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Do the Iranians right now care, or are they, or is their end state so fixed on disruption and chaos? No, there's no real strategic end state. It's just that chaos, and I think that's often overlooked. I think we often overanalyze these people's those groupings' strategic end state in sort of Western terms, and quite often that's not the case. They just want to cause death and chaos, as Hamas have proven. So are they going to be deterred by carrier strike groups? Maybe not, but Iran will. They'll know they're there. Russia and China will certainly know they're there, and it's got to have an effect. How can it not? How do you quantify that? That's a sort of PhD level thesis stuff, but it's got to make a difference. So they're setting the conditions to be ready to fight, or be ready to go in, send their ships in, and do these evacuations. And that's what all these ship movements right now are about.
So the Iranians, whose objective in terms of Israel is said to be the annihilation or the eradication of the state of Israel, you don't think there's any great master plan in play at the moment, or you think they're just carrying on with the usual disruption or that they've been conducting for some years now, like in Iraq, in Syria, and also supporting groups in Gaza and also in the Lebanon as well?
I think to know the answer to that, you've got to understand the relationship between Iran and its proxies, perhaps better than I do. You know, the chain of command between Iran and Hamas and Iran and Hezbollah. You would need a better understanding of that than I currently have to know whether or not, you know, they are driving to their end state through their proxies. What Iran itself is doing, you know, again, that's a really interesting discussion, and we may come onto this, but you know, the Gulf itself, having started this podcast on the importance of that operation there to deter Iranian activities in the Gulf, is now quite bare. It's actually quite low on ships. And that's fascinating, because when we were in the planning cell looking at that conflict, what happens if it goes wrong in the Gulf, if Iran kick off? One of the ways we would start that conflict would be elsewhere, namely the Bab el-Mandeb or the Eastern Mediterranean, because it immediately gives you a force flow conundrum. You need to send assets to those areas, but the only place you've got those assets is in the Gulf. So you're taking them from the actual root of the problem. And that's what's happening now. So again, back to the big chess pieces, that Eisenhower is now set to go through Suez, which she wasn't. Originally, General Austin said she was going to join the Ford. She isn't now. She's going to go past the Ford and through Suez. That's no real surprise to me. They need another big stick, literally, south of Suez, in the Red Sea or somewhere, to just backfill and keep an eye on what's going on in the Gulf right now.
I find it fascinating that the Eisenhower is actually going to do that, because the Carl Vinson, the USS Carl Vinson, another of those big chess pieces, a Nimitz-class carrier based on the west coast of the USA, is now in the middle of the Pacific on the way to Indo-Pacific. The Indo-Pacific region, and they already have, the US Navy already has the USS Ronald Reagan there on ops. So I did think, you know, trying to guess what's happening, that the Carl Vinson might go to the Indian Ocean and then lurk around the Arabian Sea to deter the Iranians. So it makes you wonder if they're calculating that they don't want to take away too many assets from Indo-Pacific, because, of course, the American Navy is dealing with not just the Eastern Med, that's the 6th Fleet, the Middle East, that's the 5th Fleet, but the 7th Fleet has the most warships of all devoted to it at sea, and that's to counter China. So I know you've written a piece for, I think it was the Daily Telegraph, about the Chinese being already in the area of the Arabian Sea. So it also suits them as well, doesn't it, for units of the US Navy to be drawn away from activity in the South China Sea, which they're attempting to claim as their own, and that's quite a tense part of the world. So are the Americans thinking, well, we might have taken them away from the Gulf, but we're not going to take them away from the South China Sea and near Taiwan? So that's part of the global chessboard, isn't it?
Yeah, right. It's the division between the global chessboard and the immediate move. And even the US Navy only has so many pieces on the chessboard. So, and the COCOMs, the combatant commander groupings, the way that the US chops up the world is always fascinating to watch. So you've got Indo-PACOM doing that fleet, and you've got CENTCOM pulling the strings in the Eastern Mediterranean. And if you're to swap assets between those those COCOMs, that takes SecDef sign off. They are mandated to have X number of carriers in certain areas. So you can't just bend one from there to there without significant discussion, paperwork, et cetera, et cetera. And each COCOM wants to protect its own assets. So Indo-PACOM will be saying, no, hang on, what is the big game here? Are we just taking everything to focus on that tiny strip of land? Look at the bigger picture here. Meanwhile, CENTCOM will be saying, yeah, but look where the fight's about to happen. So, you know, these are the Pentagon and White House level discussions that will be going on. The problem with the chess analogy is that you just imagine you can move a pawn four paces forward or the bishop diagonally, and it's painless. But even the Eisenhower sailing early and going straight to operations, that's a lot of pain. You know, the workups and the workup of the, you start with the engineering fraternity, then you expand it to the ship, then you expand it to the ship's aircraft. You have to kind of, you know, vector these things out, because if you've spent any time alongside, which she had, then these skills have perished, crews have changed, people have swapped. So on a very basic level, just getting that one aircraft carrier out of the door early and sprinting east. In fact, she's not sprinting, and people are asking why not, and this is why not. They're getting themselves ready because they need to arrive across whatever the line of longitude is in the Eastern Med, ready to fight. So they're taking a little bit of time. Again, these discussions we'll be having, someone will be going, you need to go faster, and it's all measured. So you can't just move these pieces infinitely. It's got to be done very carefully. And if you do, let's say something really massive happened and you needed four carriers in the same place, well, you can do that. But that's going to have ripple effects for the next 4 or 5 years. Your whole cycle is now completely out of kilter. So it is a game of chess, but it's a very carefully played one.
And those comms you mentioned, that's Indo-Pacific Com, CENTCOM, which is the Middle East Central Command, and then there was Eurocom, wasn't there?
But yeah, they've got Europe, yeah, Africa. Yeah. I think there's a High North and there's a Cybercom. I might be out of date on that.
Yeah,
but
they change.
The Eastern Med is fascinating because it's convergence. There's Africa, Europe, and CENTCOM all in the same area. So again, they'll have worked a lot of that out. And this is perhaps one of the advantages of sending the Mount Whitney.
Yeah.
When it looked like there were going to be two carrier strike groups in the same part of the ocean, you know, the military likes a clear hierarchy. Two groups with the same seniority in charge at the top. It shouldn't happen, but you can understand how that could get complicated. So putting in the vice admiral just kind of eradicates right. that in one.
So that's the vice admiral in command of the 6th Fleet aboard the USS Mount Whitney, which is based in Italy, and is a lot of these useful warships, warships, useful naval vessels. They don't look very pretty, but they've got a heck of a lot of utility for a particular role. So the Mount Whitney is a command ship, isn't it?
It is, and the command role is a function that a lot of ships are asked to do. I mean, HMS Duncan is doing it right now with the NATO group in the Adriatic. In fact, I think she's now left the Adriatic, but she is the command ship. There's a UK Commodore on board, and she is running SNMG-2, Standing Naval Maritime Group 2. But a Type 45 isn't optimized to be a command ship. You can do it, but the staff and the extra bandwidth you need for intelligence all has to be worked around the existing ship's infrastructure. The bigger the ship, the easier it becomes. So our aircraft carriers are configured to do it. HMS Queen Elizabeth is configured to do it. By the time you get to Mount Whitney, that is her core task. That is what she was designed, you know, to do. And so really the bespoke solution, they're old now, but they still have they've been updated with all the technology and all the communications equipment required to conduct that.
And that's Matt Whitney and I think the Pacific Fleet Command ship Blue Ridge. They're the two vessels you're mentioning there. And then you mentioned HMS Duncan, Type 45 Daring Class destroyer, commanding, as you say, SNMG. One of two NATO standing groups of multinational composition. And she was in Turkey at the time this whole war erupted. And then the group went to the Adriatic, which was an area where the USS Gerald R. Ford had been hanging around with her strike group most of the time, watching the Russians, of course.
Exactly, yeah. Right.
So the Royal Navy, let's just have a brief discussion about the Royal Navy. We could go on for a long time about the Royal Navy. But in terms of this whole crisis and everything else, the Royal Navy's got the destroyer HMS Duncan in the Mediterranean, the two Royal Fleet auxiliaries, the Lime Bay and the RFA Argus, there as well. So is the Royal Navy, is it actually stepping up to the plate when it comes to a big crisis, such as what we have now, but actually worse than what we would have now?
Yes, if we had a break the piggy bank moment, as I sometimes call it, yeah, the answer to that is yes. But I've actually spoiled my own punchline. Yes, we could do it, but then what? It's not dissimilar to the conversation about the US nuclear carriers. if this went absolutely kind of, you know, the balloon went up and we had to sail the Navy, then it would be amazing what we could do. The ships that are currently alongside would be turned around. I mean, almost sort of Falklands style. HMS Queen Elizabeth has jets on board. How many jets could we realistically bounce onto her in very short order? Now, again, it's not just as simple as putting jets on. They have to be qualified day and night. They have to be weapons trained. So none of these are quick. This is not an overnight job. But there is always the capacity. The First Sea Lord and the Chief of the Defence Staff always has the capacity to say, okay, this is the one, let's go. We're very much not doing that at the moment. In fact, it feels almost the opposite. We've sent two Royal Fleet auxiliaries that are perfect for the NEO task that I described, the evacuation. They're very good for that, but not much else. They've got some Royal Marines on board, so there's an effect there. But if you compare that effect to the US groups, then it's minimal. What they are, they're there ready to take UK citizens in the event of a non-combatant evacuation. So far, so good. But they're not protected. They're not protected by us, at least. So in order to provide that protection, there is a very real threat there, from small boats to longer range attack craft to a credible and previously used surface land to surface missile threat, including a couple of quite nasty sort of Russian export missiles. One of which is the Onyx missile, codenamed Yukont, and that's really fast, really heavy, twice the weight, twice the size, twice the warhead of the missiles that sunk the Moskva, and it's Mach 2.2. The Neptune missiles that sunk the Moskva are subsonic, so it's a bad missile. Not that there are necessarily any good ones, but it's credible, and Hezbollah have them. And they're on mobile launchers, et cetera, et cetera. So if you're going to put RFA, Lion Bay and Argus close in the Eastern Med, then the location of that threat, and that's just one missile. There are many others, and there are many others in the scope there. Then you have to be very sure that those ships are protected. If not, you're taking unnecessary risk. Now, there's two ways they can be protected. One is to put them under the US umbrella. As we've said, there are plenty of ships there. But if you tot up all the entire US sort of armada, and you don't count the patrol boats in the Gulf, but in the region, I make it 22 ships in total, of which 9 are what we would call high value units, big ships. Ships that you can't afford to lose. Now that's not a great ratio, actually. 9 heavies to 13 escorts is not a brilliant ratio, particularly as some of them are through Suez and in the Red Sea. My point that I'm slowly getting to here is that if Lion Bay and Argus need to go inshore and need to lean on the US umbrella to do so safely, there's a discussion to be had about how that would be received by the US. They'll do it. Of course they will. And they might be doing it anyway for their ships as they go in, perhaps at the same time. But it's just one of those things where you know, there's a discussion to be had there, particularly when we've got an asset in HMS Duncan very close by whose day job is to do exactly that. So I would be, and I try not to jump on, you know, become a sort of single issue person, but the fact that Duncan is still doing NATO duties and not delegating that, taking the Commodore and his staff off and putting them somewhere else and steaming south now to pick up the two RFAs causes me some trouble.
But might Duncan be doing that? I mean, do we know?
Well, or, good question. Now, again, this is actually the second part, is that our communications around this have been very vague.
Yeah.
The Prime Minister talked in general terms of the two RFAs. He did at least call them RFAs. That gets confused. They get confused routinely with the Royal Navy, which causes them some angst. He said they were going to operate somewhere in the Southeast Mediterranean, Egypt, somewhere like that. I think that was a generic sort of let's keep them out of the missile envelope. But if you draw a 200 nautical mile line down the west coast of that western coast, Egypt is in it. Bits of it. So how safe are they? And we're not really talking about our ship movements. We're not really talking about the destroyer. We're not really even the carrier. You know, I know discussions are ongoing about what to do with HMS Queen Elizabeth regarding this whole scenario. We're not publicizing any of that. So rightly or wrongly, we've just taken a very different posture in that regard to the Americans.
Yeah, I did find it interesting that I think it was Lloyd Austin, when he made his statement, actually listed all of the US Navy warships in the Eisenhower strike group and also the Gerald R. Ford carrier strike group. And I think what you're actually saying there as a communication specialist is the value of deterrence in letting your potential foe know that the firepower, if they want to take a chance, is formidable and they'll pay a price. So in my mind, the problem with the Royal Navy is that it doesn't have that formidable firepower. So it has to be very mysterious about what's going on. And as you say, we could lock in under the umbrella of the US Navy. But I think that's also something that happens with submarine movements. Royal Navy submarine movements are shrouded in mystery at all times, even more than they were in the Cold War. Whereas the US Navy uses the occasional visit of a guided missile submarine to, let's say, Busan in South Korea to send a message to the North Koreans. And it also does the same in the Mediterranean with those same guided missile submarines. And also about its attack submarines as well. So I think that often what happens in the UK, and this could be a whole podcast on communications, is that the UK often uses the mystery and the lack of information to hide the fact that its cupboard is fairly bare. They don't want you to know, for example, with submarines, that there might be, and I know there was a whole furore recently about how many submarines were at sea, which, you know, we didn't really get that involved in. They don't want you to know there aren't any submarines at sea. They don't want you to know that we have too few warships. So I think sometimes the political imperative in the UK is to hide that we don't have a lot to actually send or that's available or that would be ready. So that's just my slightly cynical perspective on that.
I think it's fair. You know, if we had unlimited, let's just your submarine point is absolutely valid, and the carrier strike groups are vocal about the fact that they have submarines with them. Now, is it one? Is it two? Is it three? We don't know.
You mean the Americans carrier strike?
The Americans. Oh, sorry. Yeah. So again, even in that space, they're much more forward leaning on what they've got. Back to our communications, if we had unlimited destroyers, let's say 12, and you know, there is no doubt we would have a Type 45 with the RFAs right now. It makes absolute sense. You've then got UK organic protection for those two high value units. So if you haven't got that, then you've got a choice. Do you make out that you don't, you know, do you just keep quiet? Or do you make out that you don't need it because the situation doesn't really require it, you know? And we're having these conversations with the Americans. That feels to me like where we are. If we had the choice, we would have destroyers there. We'd have a submarine there probably as well, but we don't. So we always end up having to sort of find this middle ground, which with the bolder the US communications gets about this, the the more feeble it makes ours sound. But again, I don't know which is right. I don't know which is right. I don't know whether we are underplaying it, overplaying it, or getting it just right. Time will tell. But I do wish we had more ships to get, you know, to be heading that way right now.
Yeah, and of course, HMS Triumph, the last surviving Trafalgar-class submarine, was actually in the Mediterranean not long ago and filled in for an Astute-class SSN. And it's a whole different debate for us to have another time. But the problem there, of course, is that we have too few at sea. And so Triumph has come off station. And who knows, may have gone back out there again. We don't know. But I suspect that, as usual, the silence is due to not having enough and also maybe having these discussions and deciding that we for this one at this time don't need to get involved and our resources are stretched too thin.
Well, also there's a sense that, you know, the fleet, the whole fleet, including the submarines, there's an awful lot of work going on with the carriers right now to A, keep them both deployed at sea and then also prepare for the next big deployment to the Far East. So the carrier strike group deployment out there in 2025, I mean, it seems unimaginably far away from a newspaper perspective, even from a political perspective, but from a naval planning perspective, it's not. It's the next big one. So there's a lot of energy going into making sure that all those pieces of our strike group are in place for 2025. Now, is that right? Again, is that right or is that wrong? That comes down to the fundamental judgment call as to what the priority is. And for right now, the priority has been deemed by UK government for the carriers to stay where they are and carry on doing the good work they're doing with those bits and pieces, and that the Eastern Med is kind of taken care of. And I think, you know, moving Queen Elizabeth to the Med now would be a mistake. I don't think there's a need for it. I think it's covered. And I think she's doing excellent work elsewhere as part of the NATO posture up in the north. Again, that hasn't gone away. In the same way that you described the South China Sea and the kind of belligerence that's going on there, that hasn't gone away. The High North and the North Atlantic, that problem hasn't gone away. So the navies are constantly trying to avoid playing whack-a-mole and just darting to the next crisis, because they have to plan, they have to operate and see it over a much longer time period than that.
Yeah, and that High North thing is, of course, our friends the Russians, and keeping an eye on them and what they might be up to. And it was interesting that the HMS Prince of Wales over in the Western Atlantic is working very hard with the Americans, and particularly the US Marine Corps and its helicopters, tilt rotor aircraft, and also the F-35Bs of the UK and the US Marines have been aboard HMS Prince of Wales, the second carrier. And this week or the week before, something will be in the next magazine because I had to edit a piece on it. There was a visit by the future Chief of Naval Operations, we think, the uniform boss of the American Navy, and with the First Sea Lord, and also the head of the US Marine Corps, to HMS Prince of Wales to sign a new cooperation agreement, which you mentioned the 2025 deployment to Asia Pacific. That presumably is to set the scene for a repeat of the US Marine Corps sending aboard a squadron, who knows, maybe two, of F-35B jets for that. So, as you say, they're doing an awful lot of hard work there. Well, thanks for coming on and having a good chat there. I found your account of the Gulf, even though I've been there myself, I was getting quite tense there and probably didn't realise the danger I was in. So thanks very much for that, reminding me of all that. And it was great to have your take on all the other topics.
Thanks.
For more Warships IFR, you can visit our website at warshipsifr.com, follow us on Facebook at warshipsifr, and also Twitter at warshipsifr. And we also have a YouTube channel called Warships IFR TV. Thank you for listening, and there will be another episode of the Warships Pod unleashed soon.